June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's Collective Management Committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
CKUT is hiring a spoken word coordinator. Do you have a passion for storytelling and amplifying perspectives outside of the mainstream media landscape? Are you interested in working at a collectively run, independent community radio station? CKUT's Spoken Word Coordinator is a full-time position starting June 1st that is responsible for the coordination of all CKUT's spoken word programming and is part of CKUT's Collective Management Committee. The position is 35 hours a week, pays $18.36 an hour, and applications will be accepted until 9 a.m. on May 3rd, 2021. Please visit ckut.ca for more details. We're looking forward to hearing from you.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. We've got a special interview today with Mar from the musical project For Esme. Now, for those who don't know, For Esme is a music project and an unabashedly feminist exploration of self-love and the courage of conviction in uncertain times. The songs of For Esme push the limits of pop and provokes an honest exchange of identity and inner voice. Here is our interview with Mar from For Esme.
I'm Mar Meredith. I'm the front woman and general creative director of For Esme, which has been my musical project for, I've actually lost track of how many years, I guess we must be pushing seven now, maybe more. And we've put out three records, two of which I put out with like the group of bandmates that I've been working with for a while now. The most recent one was Righteous Woman in 2018. And yeah, in COVID, I'm like making music, but I don't have anything to put out in the immediate future, but I'm definitely working on new stuff and thinking about new stuff. So I'm excited to talk more about that maybe later.
So I want to go way back. Can you tell me about how you got into music in the first place and how For Esme came together?
Sure. I've always loved music ever since I was a tiny human. My parents were always like, they're not super musical, so they were always confused about why I like wanted to sing and dance and perform all the time. But yeah, I've always loved singing. I think I always had an interest in writing music, but I definitely didn't have confidence that I could do it myself until probably university, I think, is when I started writing music. And I was just writing on acoustic guitar, and I started having a lot of fun doing that. And I quickly realized I was having so much more fun writing music than I was like doing my undergrad degree. So after university, I moved here to Toronto to like really try to take a chance and focus on this. And so after a couple years, I came up with the Fur as Me idea. I've always been a really big fan of J.D. Salinger's writing, which is where the name came from. I've since realized that J.D. Salinger is like super problematic in a bunch of ways. I think he had a lot of issues with mistreating young women. So I'm kind of reckoning with that right now. But since my project's so feminist, and I always try to think about how, like, I don't know, if Esme is the little girl from that story, that's maybe, now that I'm older, looking back, like kind of being preyed upon by an older man. I like to think that at least the music I'm writing about is about giving voice to young women, and a voice that I wish I had when I was younger. So I don't know, I'm still kind of struggling with that, but it's something I definitely acknowledge and I'm thinking about. But that's where the name came from. And yeah, we were a trio for a while. Then it's kind of been moving parts. I love to change it up, and the bigger my ideas get, the more people are required to make them happen. So right now, well, most recently when we've toured, we've been a five piece, and I'm collaborating with a few people from that five piece on the work I've been working on this year. But it's all kind of a work in progress, and it can always, I like that it can always change who the cast of people that are going to perform are.
So on the official site, it says that For Esme is, quote, an unabashedly feminist exploration of self-love and the courage of conviction in uncertain times. I don't know if you wrote uncertain times before COVID.
It was, actually. I kind of forgot about that. Yeah, now it's more uncertain than ever.
But can you tell us a bit more about why, or about this feminist exploration and what it means to you in the project?
Sure. I've identified as feminist for a long time. Like, specifically, I remember since when I was doing my undergrad and learning about, even just realizing how underrepresented women were in academia, and how, like, all the readings I was doing in my politics classes were all by, like, old white men, and how reading a reading a woman's perspective was often deemed as, like, a radical thing, and I was like, it shouldn't be radical, it should be normal. But yeah, I think ever since I've been doing music, like, it's always been important for me to write about, I'm really interested in cultural critique and, like, interrogating the things that I think are wrong with the world. And often, I don't like to be too, like, prescriptive about what I think other people should be doing to make the world better, but it's often more interrogating myself about what I could be doing, or how I could be living to be more overtly feminist, I guess. And we're probably going to get into this later, but I'm actually doing my master's right now at U of T in this program called Community Development and Adult Education. So this semester I'm taking a class on feminist theory, and it's been so much fun for me to be back in that world. And it's like feeding my brain so much in terms of, it's a lot of amazing thinkers that I always have been interested in, but to have to study them kind of academically is exciting for me. But this semester we're reading a book called Living a Feminist Life by Sarah Ahmed. And it's blowing my mind. Like, it's already stuff I've thought about, but she's just giving voice to all these things that I've been writing about and thinking about for a long time. And it's cool to see them in a different form, like a non-musical form, and think about what that means. And I think, I mean, I've talked about this in the record and since, but, like, you know, I'm a white, straight, cis lady. And so my feminism is always expanding, and I'm trying to expand it to be a lot more broad and to include a lot more other perspectives and voices. And I'm increasingly thinking a lot about what capitalism and decolonization mean in terms, like, I don't think feminism is going to be super valuable without those pieces now. And I guess I've always known that, but I'm getting more into that now.
So speaking of this, your music obviously follows these themes. I want to play a song for our listeners called For Others. Can you tell us a bit about this song?
Sure. So I wrote For Others around when I was getting married to my husband, Charlie, who's like one of my oldest, dearest friends, and he's fabulous. But I had a lot of weird things about getting married. I wasn't even sure if, like, that fit with my feminist agenda or not, but I also wanted it. So it was confusing, and I felt like I was kind of struggling with this, what felt like a diverging choice of, like, am I going to pursue music, or am I going to pursue, like, having a family and a husband and a life that is, and I've since realized that of course it's possible to have both, but I don't think our culture, like, makes it easy to have both. And I was really struggling with the concept of whether or not I wanted to have kids, which is funny because now a couple years later, like all my friends are having kids this year. And I'm like, oh, you know what? Kids are cool. Like kids are actually awesome. And it's not as scary to imagine having a life and having kids. But that's where I was at when I was writing that. And I was really struggling between those two things.
So this is the song For Others by For Esme. You just heard the song For Others by For Esme. So we've interviewed many musicians over the years to speak about their gendered experience of the music industry, whether that's on tour, writing, performing. I'm curious what your experience is working in music and if you've encountered or observed any similar limitations as a woman in music.
Yes, I sure have. I think it's hard to be a woman in music. I think any woman in this field can probably relate to that. I've run into tons of sexist bullshit over the years, and people condescendingly telling me what to do, and men assuming I don't know how to use my gear or don't know how to do a sound check, or just generally being like mansplained to about all kinds of stuff. But I also recognize, like, I really recognize that a lot of women have it harder than I do. I've had access to things that lots of women don't, and I'm always conscious when there's like, I think there's such a push in the industry right now to have better representation when it comes to women, but then you'll be like, oh, it's interesting that all these women were invited, but we're all white, or all these women were invited, but we're all cis and straight. And it's like, I don't know. I think I'm increasingly conscious that even though my experience has been hard, I need to use that, my anger about how hard mine has been, to advocate for other people who have it even harder. But yeah, it can be the worst for sure. But I also think, I will add, I think it was around 2014, 2015, I started like really getting to know a lot of other women in the industry, especially here in Toronto. And it totally changed my life and it totally changed my career, because working with women and like collaborating and sharing the experience and having each other to talk to, like, it just made everything so much more fun and so much more fulfilling and exciting. So even though it's hard, I think, I don't know, I wouldn't trade. I would not want to be a woman in the music industry. So yeah. And I think it's changing slowly. I mean, it's interesting to still see, I know last week I noted like more abusers in the Canadian industry are being outed, and I know there's more to come. And that sucks. Like, it's hard to see that men are still not held to the same standard by any stretch as the women in this industry are. But I'm hoping it'll change. I'm hoping it's changing.
Yeah. So you mentioned people being held accountable, as well as having more representation in the music industry. Are there any other things or solutions you think that would help women get into music?
Yeah, I mean, I think having mentors is so important. And I think that's important in every field. And it's something I've been thinking about and reading about in the schoolwork I'm doing lately, too. Like, it's hard in academia if you look up and you don't see any women professors in your field, or if you don't see any women of color in your field, if you don't see any trans people in your field, and you're like, well, can I fit into that space? So I know for me, when I meet and can look up to women who are like incredible audio engineers or incredible producers. Like, when I started music, I didn't know a single woman who produced their own music. I mean, I knew Grimes did it, but like, even then everyone was like, does she really write her own music? And now it's like, of course, like, so many women do these things and they do them so well. And I've had amazing experiences. Like, my favorite two audio, my two favorite sound techs that we ever tour with are both women, and they're like honestly better than any of the men I've ever toured with. But I think it's cool, because now when other women come to those shows and they see those women killing it doing those jobs, it gives you like a belief that you could see yourself in that role too. And I think that's cool, and I think it's important. And I think even just like, I remember being really nervous when I was younger to speak up about the things that I thought were unfair. And then since I now have a lot less problem doing that. But I think it's important to see other people do it, because when you see other people be like, this is unjust, or this isn't fair, or this shouldn't be that way, then you feel braver to be like, yeah, I also have experienced that, and I don't think it's right either. And, you know, power in numbers.
I'd like to turn to another song. So this song is called Small Talk. Now, the video for Small Talk is one of my favorites. Can you tell us a bit about the idea and the concept behind it?
Absolutely. So this is like, I mean, I made quite a few music videos over the years, but this is my favorite one for a bunch of reasons. One is that I got to collaborate with Amy and Nora of Quote Unquote Collective, who are like this incredible feminist theater duo. And if you don't know them, you should check them out. They've made this amazing play and movie called Mouthpiece, and another play called Now You See Her. And they're both just like, I don't know, they're the coolest. I love working with them. And they directed this movie, or this music video. And we had so much fun, like, interrogating what it's like to repress your feelings in public and try to be okay when you're not, or try to be, I don't know, I feel like so often I'm like feeling like I need to put on a happy face or like be sunny when I don't feel sunny or smile when I don't feel like it. And so it was fun to explore through movement what it feels like when you're kind of erupting and you're trying not to. I also used to dance a lot when I was younger, and I really love dance. And so being able to incorporate that into my music in a new way is super exciting. So it was so fun to make. And as you see, if you watch the video, like some of it was super intimidating. Like I had to do my little eruption dance on the GO train, and we were totally shooting guerrilla style. Like we were not supposed to be there, and everyone was looking at me and pointing at me, and I felt so self-conscious. So it took a lot of bravery. And I say that because I feel like Amy and Nora really, like, they're so brave about the way they do their art, and it gave me a lot of inspiration. So it was a lot of fun.
Try.
So what are you working on now? And how has quarantine been for your creative process?
So I would say, I guess, two things. On the one hand, so I applied for this master's program more than a year ago, like a year and a half ago, maybe. And I just knew I was working on a new record and I was having fun on it, but I was also like running into a lot of blocks and I was struggling with the subject matter. I really want to, the focus of my next record and the thing I'm like really interested in right now is alternatives to capitalism and a criticism of capitalism. I think that so often when I'm like interrogating things that are wrong, whether it be through like in patriarchy or in colonization or all these things, like capitalism is this underlying worldview that creates so many of the problems. Like it's the inherent problem with climate change. It's a problem with so many things. And I was really struggling to find the words for that. And I guess, like, I mean, it's hard to write pop music about stuff like this, but I found out about this master's program and I got really excited because they really encouraged artists and all kinds of people to do it. Like it wasn't just for academics or it wasn't just for people who are teachers. And it's a focus on adult education. And I was kind of realizing, like, I guess I've always hoped my music is kind of a tool of adult education in a way, like a way of making people think and question things. So it is a total fluke that, I mean, I got in February 2020 and then the pandemic hit in March, and I'm so grateful because I don't know what I would be doing with my time right now if I didn't have this. Pandemic's been hard. I know it's been really hard for everybody. I miss my bandmates. I hate not being able to see them and collaborate. I'm a really social I'm like an off the charts extrovert, so not being able to see people is really not that fun for me. And it's hard for the music making too, because I'm like a collaborative person. I like the energy of people together in a room making stuff. I also like had to move out of my house because it's under construction, and so I'm living in this, I'm like displaced from my home, and there's all these things going on, and it's been a lot. But I feel grateful that I have something else to focus on, because so many of my bandmates and my peers are a lot more in a more precarious situation right now than I am. And I really feel for them because it's really hard to know when anything's going to start back up again. And I have friends who've been releasing music this year, and it's cool because people are at home and they're sad and they want to listen, but they can't tour and they can't promote it in the ways that they would, and they can't necessarily shoot music videos the way that they would, and they can't go have meetings with people and go network and do all these things that are such a fundamental part of trying to get your music heard. So yeah, I don't know, it's a hard time to be a musician, and I think I'm so conscious of just like, it's a hard time that doesn't have an end. Right now we just have no idea when that's going to end, and it feels like the last priority, and understandably the last priority. Like I get that, you know, having concerts start again is not anyone's first priority right now, but what I would do to be in a crowd, like listening to live music, I would do anything.
Yeah. Oh, I know you're not alone in that. Might not be a priority, but a lot of people are itching for that for sure. So you mentioned you've kind of been working on some new things. Do you want to share about what that is and maybe what people can expect in the future with your music?
Sure. I have to say it's a lot of big question marks right now. Like I've been working on it for a while, and like I said, I kind of felt like I hit a bit of a roadblock. Mm-hmm. And now I've been doing school, and I've been honestly so busy with school that I haven't had as much time as I imagined to be writing music. But at the same time, everything I'm learning, I know it's going to go into music. Like I'm having such a transformative worldview kind of experience right now that I am excited about what's going to come of it. So like this semester, for example, I'm taking this feminist theory class, and I'm taking an Indigenous worldviews class, which is like totally blowing my mind. And I have the most amazing professor. Her name's Dr. Wemigwans, and she's the most like warm and open, awesome person teaching us about how to approach decolonization in this way that's like not super intimidating. And it's really welcoming and beautiful. And it seems to offer so many answers to things that I feel like from a colonial perspective, I'm like, yeah, like how are we ever going to dismantle capitalism? Or like, how are we ever going to actually achieve like feminist equality? And it's like, there's so many amazing ideas that have been here since before settlers came that we, if we just like look back, they're there. So I'm toying with all these ideas and I have so much I want to say and write about, but it's also intimidating subject matter. And I also am super conscious of like, I don't want to center my voice in that conversation. And yet I'm excited to explore what that could look like. Before the pandemic hit, I'd probably written, I want to say 5 or 6 songs that I imagined were going to be on this next record. And now I don't know if they're going to be on it or not, because so much has changed and so much is like in flux, I think. But I still really like those songs, so there's a good chance they will. But I think that whatever, like my semester will wrap up in April, so very soon. And then I'm really hoping to focus my summer heavily on music and now taking all I've learned and making something out of it. And I'm not totally sure what that's going to be yet. Like maybe part of me is like, maybe I should just do a 180 and like record it all on with the guitar instead of my normal like keyboard and the arpeggiators. But then I love dance music, so I don't know. We'll have to see.
Dance music, yeah, dance is important right now. For sure, actually.
This book, the feminism, Living a Feminist Life book I was mentioning, talks about how one of the things in your feminist toolkit should be, well, it talks about being your body, but how dancing is a feminist pedagogy. And I was like, dancing is a feminist pedagogy. Like, I don't know. I feel like dance is where I can feel so free and feel so myself sometimes.
All right. We'll end the show with one of my favorite songs by Fort Esme called Doubt Mouth. Can you tell us a bit about the song before we get into it?
Sure. So Doubt Mouth is about like having the doubt to speak up and feeling like, you have to be quiet or be polite or be, you just have to be really careful not to be too much if you want people to take you seriously as a woman, which is completely unfair, but something that I was really struggling with when I was writing this record. And unfortunately that has not changed at all for me. And I don't know if it has for you or for the other women listening, but I find whatever new space I'm operating in, that same thing comes up. It's like, I just feel women get questioned so much more and get critiqued so much more and expected to be underachieve. I watched this amazing video for school the other week about, her name is Paula Williams and she's a trans woman. And she talks about her experience of living as a man first and then as a woman. And she says that once she transitioned, men started telling her that she was wrong all the time and that she never experienced that before. And it was really interesting to hear it from someone who's like been on both sides. And she's like, yeah, 100%. Like women get fed doubt all the time. And I was like, oh my God, like I already knew it was real, but it's like, there's another example that it's 100% real. So that's what this song is about, is not feeling like you can't speak up or feeling like you can't speak up and then doing it anyway.
Perfect. So this is Doubt Mouth by Fort Esme.
Keeping quiet.
for those who want to follow your music, support you online, where's the best place to find you?
It's all on Spotify. And of course, but I also am very conscious that Spotify is evil and we all should stop promoting it. So Bandcamp is a great place to buy it or to listen to it. I have so much fun working visually. So I'm really on for the songs that I do have videos for, like I love sharing them on YouTube. It's on everything. It's on Apple Music. I think it's probably on Amazon, but I don't know how to find that. I will shout out in the name of the pandemic that Bandcamp is really cool and it's been doing a really fabulous job of supporting artists this year, and I'm pretty grateful for that.
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. You just heard our interview with Mar from the musical project For Esme. Up next, bringing you a recording from a panel on emotional labor and abuse, and explored the intertwined concepts of emotional labor with emphasis on gendered and racialized dimensions.
Today, like most days, I feel sad. I struggled to get out of bed today, to eat something, to sleep last night. But today, like most days, no one will know, because I will brush my hair, put on a reasonably cute outfit, and maybe even wear some makeup. I will then arrange my face into a neutral posture that can easily spread out into a smile when someone looks at me. If I have a tough moment, I will go to the bathroom and hide any evidence of my sadness. There, I will cry privately and wait for the moment to pass. Then I will fix my face again, throw back my shoulders, and reemerge. And, as always, when anyone asks me how I am doing, I will grab from my well-rehearsed monologue that always begins the same. Doing just fine, you? I do this not because I am ashamed or because I enjoy lying. I do this because this is the emotional labor the world expects from women. Smile. You see, it's not that there's no place for emotions in the classroom or at work. Rather, it's that only the so-called positive emotions are deemed appropriate. And this, by the way, is by design. The phrase emotional labor was first coined by sociologist Arlie Hochschild in her 1983 book, The Managed Heart, where she defined it as a form of emotion regulation that creates a publicly visible facial and bodily display within the workplace. As such, emotional labor is deeply tied up in pretending. Researchers call this surface acting and deep acting. Surface acting is a process through which we alter our outward expressions even though our internal feelings are unchanged. Deep acting is a form of self-hypnosis whereby employees change their internal feelings to align with the appropriate emotional display, say, for example, by imagining their last vacation. This is a type of acting that employees in the public service sector use to regulate their emotions. Think about a customer service rep being yelled at for enforcing some vampire capitalism policy that they have no say in. But instead of yelling back, they continue to speak calmly and politely, telling you they're sorry, you're disappointed, and is there anything else they can do for you today? Instead of what they want to say, which is probably, listen, buddy, it's not like I'm over here living the dream either. Most people feel like these conversations are bullshit, and that's because they are. The person on the other line is faking it with you because that's their job, to be accommodating and sympathetic no matter how tired or upset they are. The goal, whether surface or deep acting, is to show only positive emotions that will impact the feelings of customers and bottom line outcomes like sales or repeat business. These emotional labor demands and display rules are viewed as characteristic of certain jobs in the service industry like restaurant workers, telemarketers, bill collectors, and nurses. But here's the problem. I do not work in a restaurant. I am not a bill collector or a nurse. So why am I expected to engage in the same sort of labor, to constantly offer service with a smile? As community projects manager at SEED, my role is to support students of color. Pretending does not help me do this. In fact, the work requires another type of emotional labor altogether. Empathy. I have to listen with intention and openness to facilitate difficult conversations and to be able to massage the message, that is, to translate the needs of students into a language that McGill's administration speaks. One common story I hear is this. I'm the only woman of color in my women's studies class. Every time the topic comes around to race, everybody in the class, including my professor, looks at me. But wait a minute. The person I'm speaking to is not a TA in this class. They're not giving a presentation. They do not have a PhD in this material. So what exactly is it that everyone expects from her? Surely their interest is not academic. If it were, they would look to the professor or the course materials. What they expect from her is to tell her story. Explain to us what it's like to be you. Tell me something I can't find on Google. How would someone like you react to this or feel about that? What they expect from her is her emotional labor. But she's paying for this class, for this first-rate education. Why would she be put in a position to educate others for free? Similarly, when people ask you to explain to them why things hurt you in a calm manner, they are asking you to be their customer service rep. But your identity is not a corporation, and your feelings are not corporate policies, and you are not obligated to represent anyone or anything but yourself. Some of you may know I organized a poetry showcase called Sisters in Motion. Every time people leave the space I and my co-organizers create, they always seem to say the same thing. It was magical. What they don't often understand is how much work has gone into their experience of the magic. In this way, we emotional laborers are like magicians. We're not doing our job right if you see all the effort happening behind the scenes and behind the smiles. Sisters in Motion takes months to organize. We think through everything. How should the seating be arranged so that everyone has equal access to the stage, but still feels like a community? How should we host in a way that builds up the performers and keeps the audience engaged? How do we balance the raw emotions and difficult subjects that come up so the night doesn't become draining and sad? What order should the performers be in so we balance experienced and emerging artists? What are the emotional access tools we'll employ for parents or people with social anxiety? How do we employ humor in a way that's respectful but also fun? How do we show gratitude to our volunteers even as we ask them to take on what really should be paid labor? The list goes on and on. Every seemingly off-the-cuff comment or laugh or quiet moment is considered and intentional. People often ask me how they can harness the magic of Sisters in Motion for their events, but how do I explain to them the emotional labor that comes so naturally to me? One of the things that helps a great deal is that I organize this show with other women of color. Women are well-versed in the art of navigating and managing the emotions of others, often the men in our lives. How many of us are told to smile and sit quietly and be polite? Boys will be boys, whatever that means, but girls can only be one thing, nice. Similarly, people of color are taught from a very early age how to navigate and manage the emotions of white people, and how well we listen to these lessons is too often a matter of survival. For women of color, the expectation is that we excel on all fronts. Our faces and our bodies are constantly read in ways that have nothing to do with who we are, from aggressive to exotic to sexually available to docile. And so the pressure is on us to constantly arrange our emotions and our faces and our words in ways that counterbalance these false readings. My story, for example, is one of growing up in an abusive home as a member of an undocumented family. I rightly believe that surviving my angry father, my racist teachers, my mean classmates, and the always looming real and imagined police officers in my life meant constantly presenting everything as fine, fine, fine. Because if it wasn't fine, 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 then people might be encouraged to dig deeper and discover all of the layers of not fine underneath. And then my life and my family's life would unravel in ways I couldn't imagine. I watched my mother put on a smile every day, and though it barely covered her always simmering rage, it was good enough for my father, who demanded our happy loyalty. So yeah, emotional labor, deep and surface acting, deference and friendliness and false positive professionalism, how to read someone's face so closely that you can know what they are feeling, and then molding your own face and words in the appropriate way to shape those feelings. I learned that shit when I was 3. When I think about working with other women of color, what I most appreciate is the sure knowledge that these are not burdens I will bear alone. That all of us will be laboring together to create a positive emotional experience, or at the very least, to honor the authenticity of the emotional experience we are having. In these spaces, I know I will not be expected to suffer in silence through emotional dissonance, that unbearable feeling that develops when your outward emotional expression is in conflict with how you feel on the inside or with the truth of who you are. People who refuse to do any emotional labor are emotionally abusive. Think about it. What do you imagine when you picture someone who never notices or even cares how you're feeling, who is probably completely out of touch with their own feelings and expects you, therefore, to accommodate their every passing whim because they have no clue how to regulate their own emotional worlds, who never empathizes when you're upset but instead tells you constantly to chill or calm down, who is incapable of listening to you but loves it when you listen to them, who thinks every conversation they don't dominate is a debate. I imagine an abuser. Often those who refuse to engage in emotional labor pair themselves with emotional labor experts. This is because the work of emotional labor is foundational to our well-being. We all need to feel heard, understood, and cared for in order to make it through life. And often when people who can't And often when people can't offer that to others, it's because they can't offer it to themselves. They are unable to manage their feelings. They have no sense of self-compassion and very few relationship building skills. But because they desperately need these things, they turn to others, often women and most often women of color, to provide them with these skills. I have been in a number of these relationships, and I'm sure many of us have. What's different here, though, is that we have a choice. Difficult as it often is, we can choose to leave these relationships in search of more equitable partnerships and friendships. But what happens when these dynamics play out at work and in school? Are we expected to take on even more labor and put ourselves further at risk by becoming activists in addition to employees and students in an attempt to disrupt the emotionally abusive spaces we find ourselves within? Perhaps what we need now is a new movement, one that does not rely solely on individual sacrifice, because honestly, haven't we sacrificed enough? But on all of us coming together to demand better. Think of the labor movement of the 19th century, when working people organized collectively in trade unions to campaign for better working conditions and treatment for their employers. This movement had demands that eventually developed into laws. One, for example, was the 8-hour workday, that in a 24-hour day, all people are entitled to 8 hours of rest and 8 hours of leisure in addition to their 8 hours of work. So what would be the demands of an emotional labor movement? Discussing this idea with my friends Kai-Cheng Tom and Emily Claire, we came up with three potential pillars. One, recognition. Emotional labor should be recognized as labor. It is work, and like all work, it is not easy. It takes skill, and it is draining. Those who constantly engage in and offer their emotional labor should be recognized for doing so. This would be a welcome change from today, where such labor is often invisible and assumed to come naturally to some. We are done being what researchers Cameron McDonald and Carmen Cerani called the emotional proletariat. We want recognition. Two, recompense. The best way to recognize the labor of others is to compensate them for it. Those who engage in emotional labor should be compensated appropriately. A thank you is no longer going to cut it. Thinking back to that solitary woman of color in her classroom expected to respond when issues of race come up, I wonder what compensation is appropriate for her. She is doing more work than the other students in the class, and that ought to be recognized, whether on her transcript or her CV. Women are done working for free. Didn't we settle that issue in the 60s? Mm-hmm. It's past time to step up. Three, respite. Everyone who works deserves to rest, and that includes those who offer their emotional labor on a daily basis. Whether at home, school, or work, we should have the right to take a break sometimes. And that means that the people around us have to be willing to take on this work when we can't. We are all responsible for ourselves, emotions and all, and we are all responsible to one another, emotions and all. I'm so grateful that this conversation is happening in this place, on this campus, and I look forward to it continuing. There is so much that needs to happen in order for us to dismantle emotionally abusive patterns and to share emotional labor more equitably, and it starts here with us talking to each other. Thank you.
You're listening to CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is Dragonroot Radio. We've come to the end of today's edition of Dragonroot. Be sure to tune in 2 weeks from now for more reports on gender-based issues.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
CQUT would like to thank our community sponsors, without whom our 2021 funding drive would not have been as successful. Lola Rosa, La Banquise, Tejano, Lufa Farms, Ovive, Fin du Vinyl, Constellation Records, Drawn and Quarterly, Paragraph Books, Curse Blebedeb, Left Wing Books, Adrenaline Tattoo. Make sure to pay your funding drive pledge before May 1st, 2021 to be entered into our prize draw. For details on prizes, go to ckut.ca.
CKUT, Henry Grimes, and stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
Level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
So, other than that, I mean, you know, what's going on? What do you say?
Buenas tardes.
And we'll be back.
Missed your favorite show? Not a problem. Go to www.ckut.ca and follow the link to CKUT's easy-to-use archives. Instructions are on the page. 2 months' worth of archives are stored in mono and a half a month's worth in stereo.
Pleasant good afternoon to you, Montreal.
If you're having trouble, please email sys@ckut.ca. That's sys@ckut.ca. Oh,
yeah! I want to be a motivator.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. Uno, dos, uno, dos.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.